first case is case number 63784, Citizens Outreach versus the State of Nevada through Ross Miller, Secretary of State. We have Mr. Dickerson on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Mueller also on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Benson on behalf of the respondent. So are the appellants ready to proceed?
We are.
You may do so. And would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
With the court's permission, I would ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alan Dickerson. I am here on behalf of Citizen Outreach Incorporated. I'm joined by Anne-Marie Mackin, also of the Center for Competitive Politics, Craig Mueller of the Mueller-Hines Law Firm, and Chuck Muth of Citizen Outreach. 4 years ago, Citizen Outreach mailed two flyers to Nevada citizens. Both referred to then-Assemblyman John Aseguera and discussed his activities in the legislature, but neither asked the reader to vote for or against him. Under Nevada law, only communications that advocate expressly may be regulated by the state. In 2010, that term was not defined. Consequently, citizen outreach, relying upon the commonly accepted understanding of that term as it was used in the First Amendment jurisprudence, reasonably believed that these flyers were not expenditures subject to regulation by the state. The Secretary of State subsequently disagreed. As a result, Citizen Outreach has been ordered to pay over $17,000 in fines and attorney's fees and to file reports years after the fact that will list all of its donors who gave more than $100. There are two legal problems with this result. The first is that Citizens Outreach's interpretation is correct. In 1997, when the relevant statute was passed, expressly advocate was almost universally understood to require express words of advocacy as a result of the so-called magic words test articulated by the federal Supreme Court in Buckley versus Vallejo. Second, the Supreme Court and several courts of appeals have consistently required that political activity be an organization's major or primary purpose before regulation of this type may be imposed. Beginning with the statutory interpretation question and expressly advocate under Nevada law, certain things are undisputed. First is that the term expressly advocate was never defined at the time we're talking about in the statutes. Second of all, that the term expressly advocate came out of the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, where it was specifically defined as magic words of advocacy. Third, that the overwhelming weight of authority in 2010, and certainly in 1997 when the statute was passed, held that express advocacy was limited to magic words of advocacy, such as vote for, vote against, and their like.
Counsel, in the legislative history, was there any indication that the legislature wanted the magic words test, or were they going broader?
I think there is the indication in the sense that the legislature consistently referred to Buckley as the baseline of its analysis. And in 1997, Buckley was understood, again, universally to require magic words of advocacy.
I think it's not that universally understood. There is some divergence in the understanding. And this came in a period of time where there was a second version of this statute adopted, but the statute in place at the time didn't seem to single out the magic words.
No, what it did say is expressly advocate. And even the state concedes that there's only one case that even arguably gets away from the magic words understanding of expressly advocate in 1997, and that's the Firgash decision.
And, of course, that's the Ninth Circuit, our very own circuit.
Didn't they go a little broader than magic words, talking about looking at the words that were used in the context of their use, looking to see whether or not they were in an election cycle period and one that, and what a reasonable person could kind of draw from the inference?
In a sense, I mean, I think there's a couple responses on the Firgash point. The first is that even Firgash required words of advocacy, as the court later clarified in a subsequent Ninth Circuit case. The extent that you could look to outside variables was as an addition to existing words of advocacy. So I think it's unfair to read Firgash as suggesting that there was no requirement for words of advocacy and that it was a generalized look at the context.
Well, wasn't Firgash the flyer that was put forth in that case very similar to what has been put forth in the cases before us?
I would suggest not. for a few reasons. One is, I mean, if you look at, and we've reproduced the entirety of the ad in our briefing, the FERGESH ad is very clearly about an election. I mean, the words that are used referring to the then president, you know, tried to buy entire cities, cultivates the fears of the voting public. If he succeeds, the country will be burdened for four more years. Don't let him do it, in the context of that four-year call to action. I mean, it is difficult to read the FERGESH ad as discussing any sort of issue. It's entirely about the campaign of the president running for re-election. That sort of direct connection isn't present here.
Well, actually, you've got a flyer that's, you know, you made a point a second ago with the actual words. You've got a big bolded, "We don't need any more fiddling from John Aseguera." What is that supposed to mean, and how do you distinguish that from what you just said?
Well, to begin, I don't think there's much.
Isn't that essentially suggesting a defeat?
No, because the call to action is taken in the context of the overall communication. And in the context of the overall communication, the FERGESH communication is clearly about not letting the president campaign, not letting him have four more years in office. The "don't let him do it" is about that context, about the election itself. Here there's no reference to an election in any way.
Well, let me ask you this, counsel. Over the weekend, we're bombarded with political commercials since the election's tomorrow. And the Attorney General's race, and ironically, Mr. Miller is running for Attorney General, and there's these negative ads on that are not saying vote for, they're just saying each of the candidates are terrible and they're horrible and so on and so forth, and they're on the air constantly. So under that, I was thinking of this case and watching the TV over the weekend, is would those have to be reported, you know, like that or not?
Well, I think the answer is now they would. And, okay. And that's a lot of what's going on in this case, is that the Secretary of State would like to incorporate existing clarity in the law as a result of later legislative action to define a term that everyone has conceded in this case was
ambiguous. Define or to clarify, and is it inappropriate to look at current legislation when you're clarifying a point of law?
Not at all.
That exists in the statute.
Though I would suggest that it cuts the other way from what the Secretary suggests. There's this famous line in Citizens United where Justice Kennedy says, you shouldn't have to hire a lawyer to discuss the issues of the day. The Secretary's theory of expressly advocate in 2010 when this happened, not now when things have been clarified, but in 2010 was, you need to hire a lawyer, they need to notice that the word expressly advocate isn't defined, they have to then go back to the source of the term expressly advocate, Buckley, they have to ignore Buckley, they have to go read FERGESH, they have to read the legislative history, and off an offhand comment by legislative counsel, they need to know the legislature intended to interpret FERGESH and not the overwhelming weight of legal authority in 1997.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you an easy question. If that's not what was intended back at the time that this was pertinent, please explain to me exactly what your client's flyer was doing, if not advocating against the individual who was named, against all of the frivolous enactments that this particular legislator, according to the flyer, made. Please tell me what it is, if it's not advocating for anything other than the particular candidate that was named here.
I mean, in some sense, and respectfully, Your Honor, I think that switches the burden under the constitutional analysis.
Just my question. I'm not asking you on a legal basis. I'm taking away all the stuff that you talked about just now, about having to have a lawyer know this and a lawyer to know that. Just as common Joe Q voter, what is it that this is saying?
It's saying a number of things, all of which we mentioned in our briefing. It's saying that he shouldn't be drawing double salaries. Perhaps that's a reason to call him and ask him to quit the fire department or to advocate for legislation that would change that. It says a number of things about his voting record and about things that are happening in Carson City and suggesting that those are perhaps not the road you want to go down.
And it therefore advocates what?
It therefore advocates for changes in those policies. And the standard, again, in 1997 is you have to say vote for or vote against. And the only shred the state has for saying that's not the case are these tiny offhand things that don't even refer to FERGESH by name in the legislative history. In many ways, that looks an awful lot. I, what reasonable person sitting in 2010 would have known that they had to track down legislative history to exercise their First Amendment rights?
Counsel, in the ad, it says, we don't need any more fiddling from John Osagawa at the conclusion of one of them. What does that represent?
And Your Honor, I think that's a secondary question in the sense that...
Well, it's my primary question.
All right. I don't want to make a representation as the intents or effects of the speaker, because the Supreme Court has specifically said you can't do that. That's the Wisconsin Right to Life decision that says that you can't legislate and you can't litigate, more importantly, on the basis of what did you mean by this and what is its effect on the electorate. That has been foreclosed by the federal Supreme Court, which is why we have these bright-line tests like the major purpose test, to get back to that, but also like the magic words test as it existed in 1997. That's why it was there. It was there to avoid this sort of fact-intensive inquiry so that, you know, people who do not have the resources of sophisticated counsel or well-educated law clerks
or 20 years of experience. The magic words that you wish to rely upon was not an absolute required test to be applied.
Which test is Your Honor referring to?
The magic words.
The magic words test. And again, I think the difficulty is that in some ways, the Secretary's argument relies upon needing a time machine. The law has changed since 2010. Under existing law, the concerns that are being raised here are not present because the vagueness problem inherent in the statute has been fixed. In 2010, that wasn't the case. In 2010, they simply used the word expressly advocate. And again, in 1997, when that language was incorporated, and it's clear from the legislative history, it was incorporated to protect issue speech. It was understood to be a bright-line test to vote for or vote against.
Counsel, assuming that the court agreed with your argument that the 1997 legislative history is devoid of any guidance about anything other than the Buckley test, the question for me is whether or not in 2011, when express advocacy is clarified or restated, how would you approach the standard of review that we should consider as to the effect of that language? As you know, generally speaking, if the legislature has changed the law, it would only be given prospective effect. On the other hand, if it is clarifying an existing statute, it would be given retroactive effect. And I'd like to hear your view and the analysis that you would urge the court to place in an opinion on that point.
Certainly, Your Honor. I will try to be brief.
Don't be long.
It's not a clarification to substantially change First Amendment liberties. And so in our view, in deciding to make clear that when they said expressly advocate, they did not mean Buckley. They did not mean the prevailing law and the only law binding on this court. They meant something else. That was a change in the underlying law that should be only given prospective effect. And to the extent that we are going to apply retroactive effect to later statutes, we should also look at the latest statute that limits the scope of donor disclosure in an attempt to create this fit between the donor and the communication that's going out. With your permission, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I have one additional question.
Sure, I'll give you some more time, so go ahead if you can answer.
To follow up on the question I posed in your response, is there anything in the legislative history in 2011 in which the legislature says, you know, there was this confusion arising out of 1997, and we want to straighten out that confusion, a comparison perhaps of the Buckley test versus the Fugach holding. Is there any of that present in the 2011 legislative history? And if not, how could one conclude that it clarified the 97 legislation?
Sitting here right now, I do not have the answer on the legislative history for Your Honor. That said, I do think it is possible to conclude that the legislature was trying to change a previous understanding. And the reason for that is that they did, in fact, adopt the Firgash test. But, I mean, at some fundamental level, the question is, we all concede that the statute was unclear or ambiguous, or was susceptible, at least, of our interpretation in 2010. Is it really appropriate for the state to broaden the scope of regulated political speech retroactively in that manner? And I think the answer has to be no.
Okay, thank you very much. Council, we'll give you your 3 minutes in rebuttal since we have a lot of questions. We'll add 3 minutes to Mr. Benson's time to equalize it as well. So, Mr. Benson, on behalf of the respondents.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Kevin Benson, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent. Unless the Court has a different preference, I intend to address the express advocacy issues first and then get into the constitutional issues. So first of all, with regard to the magic words test, at the time, of course, Firgash had said that express advocacy is not limited to magic words. And that was a 1987 case. Ninth Circuit, of course, where we're at. In 1995, the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, which is charged with enforcing the campaign finance laws nationally, enacted a regulation which defined express advocacy very similarly to the Firgash test. So that was the FEC's interpretation of the term in 1995, only 2 years before the legislature adopted the term expressly advocates. Then when you turn to the legislative history itself, there was some talk of Buckley in the legislative history. And the commission chairwoman said, so what does express advocacy mean anyway? And she asked committee counsel to research that exact question. And committee counsel came back after researching that question and told the committee, express advocacy means magic words or when those words are not present on the entire context of the entire content of the communication. That was the only discussion of the exact question in the legislative history of what does the term express advocacy mean? And committee counsel clearly told the committee that it is not limited to magic words. After the discussion, Senator Raggio made the motion that the language be amended, because at the time the statute said that the communication has to directly further a campaign. And so the question was, should they change directly further to express advocacy? And having just been told that express advocacy is not limited to magic words, Senator Raggio made the motion that the language should be amended so that it does not apply to strictly issued advocacy items. So that's a significant distinction here, that the motion itself indicates that it was not intended to apply only to magic words. And the committee just received counsel from their attorney that express advocacy is not limited to magic words. There's nothing indicating in the legislative history that they intended to adopt any other regulation, any other meaning of that term when adopting this statute. So with that regard, express advocacy in Nevada never was limited only to magic words. The 2011 statute merely clarified that. And it is in the legislative history where that was a bill that
the 97 intent was so clear, why was the 2011 legislation even needed?
Arguably it wasn't, Your Honor, but it was to put into the statute in plain language that magic words are not needed. Because this issue of saying that, well, if it's not clearly expressed, that it was necessarily a change, all that does is encourage people not to change the law, not to put the definition, because as you recall, there was no definition in there whatsoever. So if we are going to encourage people not to add definitions where there's been some dispute, and as I referred in my brief to the PEB case, this is very similar to that case, where there was an ongoing dispute about what the term join PEB means. And in the legislature, based on that dispute, it was clarified what that means. This is very similar in this case. And so to encourage the law to not have definitions in it, where perhaps it should, I think promotes a bad public policy, simply because if you're always going to say that that is a change in the law, then it doesn't matter what the legislature actually intended. And, of course, that's the whole point of statutory construction. That's the whole thing that we're trying to get to here, is what the legislature actually intended when it originally adopted that statute. So setting aside the 2011 statute, at the worst, from our point of view, it's irrelevant. At the best, it's a clarification, and it shows what the legislature originally intended. But in any event, the legislature had FERGACH, and they had the recent FEC regulation, and then they had committee counsel's very clear explanation of what express advocacy meant at the time.
Well, is there anything in the 2011 legislative history, which, as I asked counsel, and he apparently is not as familiar with the history, that inquires or clarifies, gosh, you know, in 97 we really intended this, but now we really mean it?
In the 2011 session, that was a bill that was brought by the Secretary, and in the Secretary's explanation of why that definition was being added, he said, this is to clarify that magic words are not needed, because some people have made the argument that if you don't literally say vote against, then you don't have any disclosure whatsoever.
So why shouldn't we take the Secretary at his word as he expressed it in 2011? We're talking about regulating people's First Amendment advocacy rights here. It seems like we should be somewhat more precise when we do that.
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, the Secretary presented that bill and that with that explanation that this is to clarify, to close what some people have called a loophole where if you don't say literally vote against somebody, then you don't have to disclose. The legislature did pass the bill. There was no discussion or concern that that was not the legislature's intent previously and that they wished to close that loophole such as it was, if it was a loophole at all. And second, what we're talking about here are purely disclosure requirements. We're not talking about any limitation on anybody's right to speech. We're only talking about providing disclosure to voters. When they get one of these...
Before you go down that road, though, I just want to clarify. There was nothing that mentioned FERGACH, correct, in the initial enactment?
It was not mentioned by name, Your Honor, no.
And nor was there anything mentioning the 1995 FEC regulation, correct?
Not that I recall.
So you are saying the legislative history supports your point based on committee counsel's statement, unsupported by any authority, as to his or her reading of what magic words meant, right?
What I am stating, Your Honor, that committee counsel clearly said that it did not mean just magic words.
Right, but there was no authority that he or she cited for that, correct?
In the legislative history minutes, as they appear, does not say that legislative counsel cited those sources.
And yet Buckley is all the way through that legislative history, correct?
Buckley is cited by various people who spoke to the legislature about what it should mean or what they thought it meant.
But and then fast forward to 2011, again, there is no, well, we meant to adopt FERGACH, but now we need to do so expressly. There's nothing like that in the 2011 either.
There's nothing explicitly that says that, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I'll point out, of course, that first, the minutes from 2011 are not as good as they are these days. And second, it's not common to have a legal discussion like we're having here today,
sure,
where we're citing cases and so forth, either, and nor do I think that we should necessarily expect that level of precision from the legislature.
And that's part of the trouble that I have, which is why wouldn't we adopt the prevailing federal view, leaving aside the FEC regulation, but adopt the Vallejo, Buckley versus Vallejo, and the federal cases that had considered it. The Ninth Circuit's FERGACH decision was kind of a one-off at that time in 97, right?
It was the only court that had held that. That's correct.
So to me, if you're looking at the text, and this legislative history stuff is a bit shaky. You're looking for shards of meaning somewhere. There's really not much in the legislative history to help us out.
I think it's quite clear in the legislative history, Your Honor. And, of course, the prevailing federal definition was the FEC's definition at that time because
okay,
that is the agency charged with enforcing these laws on the federal level. So that was the prevailing definition at the time.
And you've submitted the additional points and authorities or supplemental authorities, Committee for Justice and Fairness versus Arizona Secretary of State. How close, and assuming, you know, we consider positively the magic words aren't necessary, How similar is the material that was distributed in that case to the material that was distributed in this case?
I think that they are pretty similar. In fact, I think the ads in this case are even more overtly expressed advocacy. Because in that case, it was an advertisement run against Tom Horn, who had previously been the superintendent of public education, was then running for attorney general. And the ad criticized him when he was superintendent for supposedly letting an employee back in the classroom after being caught viewing child pornography. And it ended with showing a picture of his telephone number on the screen and said, call Tom Horn and tell him to protect children and not the people who harm them, or something along those lines. And the group resisting disclosure said, well, all this really is an issue ad designed to educate people about the issue of protecting students from child pornography. And the court said, no, this is express advocacy. You're running this ad shortly before the election, talking about a seat he's about to vacate when he's running for attorney general. This is express advocacy urging a vote against him. Here we have, this is not the call him and tell him sort of ad. This is a, we've had enough fiddling from John Osiguer. It's time to tell him to work like the rest of us. The only thing the reader can do to achieve those results is to vote against it. That's the only thing that the reader can do. Like in the Firdatch test, the reader can't have Jimmy Carter impeached, can't have him arrested, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, it's really not a plausible explanation for the voter to call up the fire chief and say, hey, why don't you fire John Osiguer? Or to call up the Speaker of the Assembly and say, we think that you should expel him from the Assembly. The only thing that the reader can do to stop him from milking the taxpayers, from getting fat off the taxpayers, from gaming the system, from doing all of those things that he's accused of doing, like in the Firdatch ad, the only thing the reader can do to stop him from doing all that stuff is to vote against him. And so, in short, the express advocacy determination does not require the court.
Why would we consider an interpretation of the effect of the ad in deciding whether the ad creates express advocacy under the definition of the statute? I mean, if we go down that road, don't courts then begin second-guessing every First Amendment advocacy that occurs? And if the court decides that the advocacy that took place carries one interpretation versus another or has a different intention than it should, you now require that it fit within the definition? That seems a little loose.
Well, what we're looking at here is not the effect of the ad. Is what we're looking at here.
That's what you were describing, Mr. Benson, is the effect of the ad on Osiguera.
That is the effect of the voter's action based on the ad. So the question is, what is the
Somebody
ad?
Might call him up and say, stop double-dipping.
That's true. Somebody might. But the question is, what is a reasonable interpretation of the action that is urged by the ad? That's the question. That's the last of the third Firdatch factors. Is it has to be clear that it's urging a vote against John Osiguer. And the point of the Arizona case is to demonstrate that the court is not obligated to take at face value any argument that a lawyer can come up with after the fact about what the intended message is behind that. The idea is that the court needs to look at this and say, is there a reasonable, plausible, alternative explanation other than an appeal to vote for or against this clearly identified case? In this case, we have two ads that criticize him for holding both jobs at the same time, that criticize his record, and you know, similarly, especially the fiddling flyer, similar to the Jane Doe ad that was discussed in the McConnell case, that the court recognized that there's really no difference between an ad run shortly before the election that criticizes Jane Doe on her record and then concludes with, call Jane Doe and tell her to, you know, tell her what you think, versus an ad that concludes with, vote against Jane Doe. That's really no meaningful distinguishing between those two ads. Similarly, in this case, when a voter gets...
These ads had been run before filing.
I'm sorry, what was
that? If these ads had been run before filing, before candidate filing, would they violate the statute then?
Disclosure would not be required because Nevada law requires that it be about a clearly identified candidate on the ballot. And so when somebody's not on the ballot yet, then you don't have an issue with disclosure. So in this case, both of these ads constitute the express advocacy definition. And to Turning then to the constitutional issues, first of all, these were all raised for the first time on appeal. And ordinarily, this court, it is within the court's discretion to hear constitutional issues raised for the first time on appeal. But that should remain the exception, not the rule. And the reason for that is we want these arguments to be thoroughly vetted in the district court ahead of time. And in this case, they take the absolutist position in their opening brief that you have to have the major purpose test and that you have to limit contributions disclosure to those who have earmarked their contributions. And I spent probably too much time showing that both of those premises are false, which they concede in their reply brief. And then they change to a new argument, which is that, well, without those, Nevada's laws are not sufficiently narrowly tailored. And that argument, of course, looks very different from the absolutist argument in their opening brief and requires a different inquiry. And I want to make clear that the inquiry is the exacting scrutiny test. It's not strict scrutiny. We're not talking about requiring the least restrictive means possible. And what it requires is an important government interest, not a compelling government interest. And any burden that the state has in this case has been met and is easily met because the U.S. Supreme Court discussed in Citizens United and the Ninth Circuit and various other circuit courts and other cases that as a general matter, the state has a sufficiently important government interest in providing the information to the voters about who is trying to influence their votes shortly before the election. And that interest is generally sufficient to require the disclosure of campaign finance data. So by citing those cases as we did, we have generally carried our burden in this case. What their argument basically comes down to is the argument that this $100 threshold is too low. So what they're mounting is a facial overbreadth challenge. And they have to bear the burden of showing that the law is substantially overbroad, both from its text and from actual fact, meaning that it regulates a substantial amount of protected speech, which is outside what the state could legitimately regulate under the First Amendment. It judged in relation to what does plainly fall within the legitimate sweep of the statute. And here we have no record at all about what the actual effects of the law were, either on citizen outreach itself or on other groups for that matter, not before this court. And so that's another reason the court should not consider these constitutional issues brought on for the first time. But if the court is inclined to consider them, I would ask the court to do additional briefing on that narrow Taylor question, since this is my first opportunity really to respond to that here at oral argument today.
Let me ask you another question. Are the jurisdictions, the way you're seeing things, are the jurisdictions moving away from the magic word test? And as a policy matter, wouldn't it be so easy to avoid any type of disclosure just by taking out the words don't vote for or vote for? And that was one of the concerns that Fergatch had as a policy matter.
Yes, you're exactly correct, Your Honor. Most jurisdictions have gone away from the magic words for exactly that reason. And even in the McConnell case, the U.S. Supreme Court, talking about the Jane Doe ad, said, you know, the lesson here is that magic words is functionally meaningless because it is so easy to get around by not using the words vote for, vote against. And there's really no difference between call Jane Doe and tell her what you think and vote against Jane Doe. And similarly, in this case, you have two ads run after the legislative session is over, during the election season, that criticize John Osagera for holding these two jobs, that says milking the taxpayers, getting fat off the taxpayers, all of those things. These are run shortly before the election. There's no difference between these ads that conclude with tell Osagera to work like the rest of us and vote against John Osagera. That's why they're express advocacy, and that's why the voters have a right to know who is paying for ads like this to try and influence their votes right before the election. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Mr. Dickerson, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. A few quick things. First of all is that, as was pointed out, the FEC's definition of express advocacy was never in front of the legislature. There's precisely no record that they even knew it existed. And to the extent that one wants to look at that, recall, of course, that the FEC was a party to Fergatch. And consequently, their reaction to that is going to be different from that of another sovereign entity like the state of Nevada. On the Fergatch question, I mean, again, we think that the We think the evidence the legislature intended to incorporate Firgach is extraordinarily weak and creates a trap for the unwary. But aside from that, the Secretary has conceded in his briefing, and I'm quoting from the top of page 12 of our brief, this is not as direct a command as in Firgach, and while he thinks it's only marginally less slow, it is not merely informative. Firgach itself said, this ad is the outer limit. This is on the line. To the extent the Secretary concedes that this is not as far over as Firgach, Firgach simply doesn't control, even if it's incorporated. And on that point, I would refer, again, as we did in our briefing at page 21, California Pro-Life Council versus Yetman, which rejected the theory, and I quote, that regulation of those communications that when taken as a whole and in context unambiguously urge a particular result in an election was what Firgach meant. The Ninth Circuit itself clarified that that's not what Firgach meant. So the Secretary's attempt to read Firgach through the lens of much later cases, a lot of what's difficult here is if you look at the Secretary's briefing, there are a lot of cases from after 2010 and an awful lot of cases after 1997. I will concede that there has been movement in the law over the last decade. That is normal. That is to be expected. The question is, what the Nevada legislature couldn't possibly have looked into the future, to future federal cases in making its decision. And citizen outreach certainly could not have looked into the future, to future federal cases in knowing what its rights were. The fundamental question, the fundamental fact, is that their rights were ambiguous under the statute, and the Secretary's attempt to yoke Firgach and then overread Firgach is the only reason we're here. The legislature has fixed this problem, has recognized it was a problem, and has corrected it. But right now, citizen outreach is looking at five figures of penalties, it's looking at being labeled a scoff law by the state, and it's looking at the disclosure of its donors. And I think that that last part is, in fact, important, and that the Secretary fundamentally does not understand the law in this area.
But let me ask you this. What is the purpose of the law in the first place? Isn't it that don't you want to encourage disclosure in these matters?
Absolutely.
And doesn't the magic word test, in fact, completely go against that concept? Well, and isn't it so easy to get around it that you can accomplish an advocacy to defeat someone just by leaving out the magic words?
If I may, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I think that's precisely the right question, and I wish I had another hour to discuss it with you. If you read Buckley, a per curiam decision of the United States Supreme Court, referred to with reverence, I think it's very difficult to take it in that spirit. When you talk about the informational interest, which is the state interest, which everyone concedes is a real interest, Buckley makes it very clear the informational interest is knowing who the supporters and constituency of a candidate are. And when they did that, they narrowed the federal statute, and they narrowed the federal statute so they would not reach organizations which were not intimately tied to the candidate. That's why you have the major purpose test. That's why you have it's all about this question of, are we really getting names? Are we really getting the supporters of this particular candidate? Or are we just getting people who, relying on federal tax law, know their contributions will be private, know they're giving to an organization that can't spend most of its budget on political activity, and want to support a particular ideological or educational mission? The idea that anyone who gave $100 to citizen outreach 4 or 5 years ago knew that these couple ads were going to be where their money went, there's no evidence of that. There's no attempt to tailor the statute to actually get at the donors who want to support or oppose a candidate. And that's the constitutional touchstone.
Thank you very much, Mike. I thank both counselors.